This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. You may have just heard the news. Anthony Scaramucci is out of a job. President Trump has removed him from the post of White House Communications Director after just 11 days. Now, people who cannot stand President Trump are thrilled about the demise of the mooch. But we're going to talk to someone who says the mocking and the outrage that's being directed at everything President Trump does and practically everyone he hires, all that is counterproductive. It just plays right into Trump's hands. So that's coming up in about 10 minutes. We're going to start the show with our local election. You know, your ballot is due tomorrow. Candidates for mayor, city council, state legislature, school board, all hoping that you completely fill in the oval next to their name with a black ink pen. Professor Scott Heutel, teacher of psychology and neuroscience at Duke University. I have my voter's guide. I have my campaign mailers. I've been listening dutifully to KUOW for weeks, so I am ready to sit down and cast a rational, informed vote, right?
Well, not exactly. We think some people do that, but many people, especially in complex elections, use things other than those sorts of ballot guides when making their decisions.
How do we really, in real life, decide how to vote?
Well, we think that there's actually two contributors to voting. So one is what you talked about, sort of using all the issues and trying to find out which candidate is closest to you on the most issues. But over the last year, we've been really exploring an idea that people actually use their identity as a guide for voting. And what we mean by identity is how the act of voting actually reinforces something like your sense of yourself as a working class person or as a military veteran or some other feature. And we think that identity actually turns out to compete with and often supplant policy in many people's voting.
So what's an example of how I might use my vote to reinforce my sense of myself?
Well, take the case of the recent U.S. presidential election. So many people thought of their vote as often like a protest, that I'm going to fight against, say, the government's traditional role in some policy. And if you looked at the expressed reasons for many people's voting, it was often to try to get back at something or to fight against something. And in some cases, it turns out people vote against policies that might be in their self-interest. And so we've been really interested in trying to understand why people often vote against those policies.
Yes, we've heard that, right? What's wrong with Kansas or on and on? Why do these people vote against their self-interest? What is your take on that?
Well, we think what happens is in many cases, the act of voting is itself more valuable than the consequences of your vote. So if you think about it like a U.S. presidential election, there's maybe 150 million people voting. And with those sorts of numbers, the idea that your vote is actually going to have any material effect on your outcomes is silly. I mean, your vote doesn't actually matter in swaying the U.S. presidential election.
Right.
But it does matter to you as an expression of your values and your identity.
So actually, you are voting in your self-interest when you vote for your identity. That matters to you a lot.
Absolutely. Your vote can be seen as a protest. So you can signal to your friends. You imagine you telling your friends afterward, well, I voted for this candidate, and I did so. And they respect that you showed the protest or you engaged in something that really reinforces your standing within that social group. We think the act of voting itself is primarily important because it does reinforce those identities. And things like economic benefits, again, your act of voting doesn't really have much effect on that. City of Seattle is going to adopt a set of policies regardless of your specific vote in this election. And your vote is not going to be the one that changes this election.
Is it still okay to look down on those people who cast an identity vote?
I think it's dangerous to do that. I mean, in some ways, some of those identities may be proxies for things. Like, for example, you have an identity as being part of your, say, racial or ethnic group, but that may also be a proxy for believing in civil rights. And so we don't think that that necessarily is something to look down on. We, in fact, just think it's what many people use.
But in an ideal world, Professor, wouldn't we want people to be so engaged in civic life that they transcend their identity and vote for policy?
Well, I think it's a more philosophical point than anything else. I would want people, of course, to be well-informed, but you can imagine that in many cases, people, their self-interest might be not what we think is good for the greater number. So, for example, for many people, if they're relatively well-off, the single best thing is lower your taxes. That has a bigger effect on your material outcomes than anything else.
Mm.
But of course, there are plenty of people who may be well off, but historically vote for whatever party is actually promising higher taxes and more social safety support. I don't think it's as clear as saying we want people to vote in their self-interest. And then when you say they want them to vote for the greater good, often that greater good can get tied to their identity.
Yeah, you're talking to a lot of well-off Seattle area liberals right now who say, yeah, I'm not voting my self-interest. That's the point.
And I think that that's, again, a perfectly reasonable explanation for what many people do. What we want to argue and what we think we have a pretty good handle on is that the way to think about voting is not just something like a checklist of policies and find the candidate who's closer to you. That especially in primaries, where a lot of the candidates are frankly pretty similar on most issues, what people use when voting is something like how their identities change with the act of voting.
Professor, when we think of identity politics, I think a lot of us think of splintering and that we're getting our backs up and we're getting more tribal and it's vicious. Do you even see a trend like that? And if so, how do you feel about it?
So the larger political science literature definitely indicates that the people we're electing are becoming more polarized. Now, the U.S. electorate isn't becoming particularly more polarized on policy positions. But what is striking is that it seems more polarized. So I think our information sources are more polarized. And that's part just a simple fact that instead of having three major networks like we did a generation or two ago, now somebody can choose from hundreds of different news sources, each of which can be pretty narrowly tailored. So I think it is clear that the media, speaking largely, provide more opportunities for seeking out narrower slices of information. But I don't know if that necessarily makes us more tribal. I think that the thing that makes us more tribal is the fact that we live in an enormous democracy. Even cities are huge. And as a result, we're not going to sway the entire vote with our own opinion. The vote matters not to change the election, but it matters to us.
You know, you mentioned cities being huge. In Seattle, we're electing a mayor now, and I often hear people say, well, I'm voting for so-and-so because they're from my part of Seattle and they really know us well. And that happens nationally, right? People vote for the candidate from their state. Is it okay if that annoys me?
I think you're a free citizen. It's okay to have it annoy you.
Thanks.
But you can imagine two things. One, that you could say we want everybody to ignore their self-interest. But in a participatory democracy, you can imagine that there's some value in having each person expressing their self-interest through their voting. And it makes total sense for somebody who says, if you're from Texas, I'm going to vote for a candidate who understands the oil and gas issues, which are more important in Texas than they would be in Washington. So the idea that people express their self-interest through their voting is perfectly reasonable in our democracy. But what we're arguing for is what I think is a striking feature of our democracy, at least now, is that we're not necessarily expressing our self-interest in terms of policy positions, but we're expressing how our votes may shape our identities. And that last bit is something often ignored in sort of modern political science, but it turns out to be a very good determinant of people's voting.
Of course, most people don't vote their identity because most people don't vote. How does that fit in?
Yeah, this has been a paradox. And usually the paradox is the question of why don't more people vote? So in my town, we had an off-cycle primary a couple years ago, which had something like 4% of people vote. And you could say, why would so few people vote? Well, the oddity from my perspective is why do people vote at all? What we think is going on is the act of voting itself is reinforcing to people. They want to be the sort of person who votes. And so they're voting for the act of voting, not because they think their vote's going to sway the election.
Right. If we didn't vote our identity in that way, we just would vote even less.
Yeah.
Finally, Professor, so you've laid out this situation. This is our brains on voting. What should we do with this information?
Well, I think the first thing is we can try to inoculate ourselves a little bit from it. So as a voter, I would be hopeful that I can see in cases where I'm being motivated by my identity or because I think this candidate is more like me, but perhaps my own self-interest would be better for going to another candidate. I think in many other cases, we should avoid thinking about identity as a negative. And what I mean by that is cases like in the U.S. presidential primaries, where once a candidate was eliminated, that candidate's supporters often had great resistance transferring to another candidate in their same party, even though the other candidate was probably very close on policy issues. And primaries in particular have this way of exaggerating differences between candidates who might agree on many, many other issues. So I think that if we can think about identity and avoid the negative aspects of the out-group features of voting against somebody, then I think we'll be better off.
Okay, vote your identity. You're going to do it anyway, but do it in an enlightened way.
That's an easy way to put it. Sometimes it's hard to do that, but that would be the goal.
Professor Scott Heutel teaches psychology and studies neuroscience at Duke University, talking to us here right about voting day. And Professor, good to talk with you. Thank you.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so your politics have a lot to do with your identity. What if your identity involves detesting President Trump? So you march or you organize against anything the president does or tweets. It feels satisfying, but my next guest says you're doing more harm than good. Professor Tom Nichols teaches national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College. Welcome, Professor.
Thanks for having me.
You are not a Trump supporter, but you think the anti-Trump outrage is counterproductive. Why is that?
Well, first, let me say two things, that I don't represent the views of the Defense Department or the Navy here, but also that I think protest and marching and public demonstrations are a core part of the American identity. It's part of who we are. It's a great and valuable tradition, and that's why I worry about when I think it's being squandered and exhausting people by putting them on a treadmill of constant outrage where at some point all of that outrage becomes so wearing and so much noise that people can't sort of lose track of when it's important to really to organize and to speak out, especially in a country where, you know, 6 out of 10 people don't vote, which I think is really the bigger tragedy.
Well, let's talk about a couple of possible examples of outrage fatigue. First of all, the news just broke that President Trump has relieved Anthony Scaramucci of his communication director job after 11 days of chaos. Isn't Scaramucci a victim of some public outrage, the mocking, the derision, and hey, it worked?
My personal view, no, he wasn't a victim of any of that. He was a victim of he was brought in to take out Reince Priebus. He did that. He got then of course went nuts in public with the events of the past few days, and I think he was taken out because of inside White House changes that really had nothing to do with protests. I mean, there weren't people marching in the streets saying, fire Anthony Scaramucci, and I think up until a few days ago, nobody had ever heard of Anthony Scaramucci unless you were really watching the kind of internal workings of Trump world very carefully. I think there was only one person that had anything to do with Anthony Scaramucci being taken out, and that was General Kelly.
Well, but there's a case where you say people were not out in the streets. It wasn't outrage at, you know, DEFCON 5 for Scaramucci. It was just, but it was a lot of mocking, and President Trump doesn't like to get mocked.
Well, he doesn't like to get mocked by the people that he thinks are his base. I mean, the problem is that a guy like Scaramucci plays really well with his base. I mean, right now, this is a president who only cares, at least in my view, he seems to only care about the 35% of the people who are still with him, who still vote for him, who are still kind of stuck right at that peg between 35 and 38% approval. So, you know, those weren't the people agitating to take out Scaramucci. This, I think, was all kind of an inside palace intrigue where, you know, my guess is that taking out Scaramucci was part of General Kelly's requirement for taking the job.
Yeah.
If you had to ask me what did it, it's that once Priebus was gone, and, you know, think of this, Reince Priebus. Nobody was marching in the streets about Reince Priebus. Most people couldn't pronounce his name. But this was all happening behind the scenes. And again, this isn't to say that people shouldn't organize and be active when something's very important to them. But if you do it every single day, you're eventually going to exhaust yourself and your ability to tell what's important from what's ephemeral.
Okay, now maybe the Scaramucci affair was a weird one-off. Let's talk about a more familiar source of outrage. President Trump tweeted last week that transgender soldiers were going to be banned from the military. And in response, you had not only the usual suspects protesting, but you had Republicans like John McCain, Orrin Hatch, former military brass coming out saying this ban was a terrible idea, and the ban still hasn't happened. Wasn't that a successful reaction?
I would argue that the ban hasn't happened because nobody knew what it meant. I mean, the first thing the Pentagon said was, we haven't heard anything about this. They've been working this issue. Apparently, General Mattis has been working this issue for a long time. And, you know, the first response was, well, we're not changing anything because we haven't been told to change anything. I think that the point of that tweet, and again, I'm looking at this as a political analyst outside the process, I think the point of that tweet was to change the news cycle, and it worked. I mean, you know, look at everything that was happening. The president's at war with his own attorney general. The Congress was handing him a veto-proof bill on sanctions. Healthcare became a flaming dumpster fire, as, you know, what you could have almost seen coming. And so, with one tweet, with a series of, well, two or three tweets, in the space of 10 minutes, the president grabs the news cycle and sends everybody into, you know, a hamster wheel over and over and over again about something that hasn't happened. And I don't think that the outrage, I think, you know, this is the kind of thing where if you ask a Republican senator like Orrin Hatch, what do you think about this? You're going to get a very standard answer of, well, I don't think it's a good idea. I mean, there was nobody taking to the floor of the Senate. There were no, I used to work in the Senate. I probably should add that, but I was a Senate staffer and a former speechwriter. And, you know, if there were something on the horizon, you'd have seen senators go down to the floor, denounce this, pass a sense of the Senate, do whatever it is that they think needs to be done. Instead, there was all this bewilderment. Because really, the point of that tweet, it seems to me, was to create a huge amount of noise in the information space to drown out all of the other terrible things that were happening in that news cycle. And it worked.
I take it you don't.
It works every time.
I take it you don't think protests like the one at SeaTac Airport stopped President Trump's travel ban? All that chaos?
No, I think what stopped the travel ban were lawyers and the president's own tweets, which were eventually used against him.
Okay.
And interestingly enough, and I think this is one message that I would try and get out here, because the way I see these tweets and travel bans, the travel ban was a great example of something that the president and his team wanted to portray as a Muslim ban, but couldn't say it that way. And so they couldn't write the travel ban that way because they knew it would never survive review. They knew it would never get very far. So they wrote this kind of halfway measure based on six or seven countries that had already been under travel restrictions. And then they let the media take the message forward that it was a travel ban, which I think was exactly the point, or Muslim ban, which was exactly the point. It was almost as if they were saying, look, we can't call it a Muslim ban, but if you want to and reassure our base that we're actually doing what we promised we'd do, we're okay with that. And I think that's exactly what happened. And there are millions of people in America now who actually think there's a Muslim ban when there's no such thing in place. And they think that the president's already running ads saying promise kept, even though nothing like it happened. And I think he used the media in a kind of judo to send that message out through the media, even though it didn't happen. And I think it was very successful that way. Unfortunately, it was very successful that way.
Okay, well, let me ask a bigger picture question, Professor Nichols. By the way, wherever you were standing about 2 minutes ago was better reception than wherever you are now. So if you could twirl around another time, you might we'll be able to hear you better. But we could pick, you know, individual cases of anti-Trump outrage. I look at the polls, I keep hearing that President Trump has relatively low, historically low approval ratings. And yes, he has a loyal base, but that the polls don't show the support of that base increasing. If anything, maybe a slight erosion. What is your evidence that there is that it's self-defeating, that this anti-Trump outrage is counterproductive?
I think you actually saw it during the primaries and during the election as well. For example, the minute that Bernie Sanders had to abandon his stage during a protest by Black Lives Matter, I remember saying at that moment, Donald Trump is going to use this. This is going to be a very effective motivation to get his voters out. And sure enough, he takes the stage and says, I will never let that happen. I'm the guy that this will not happen to. The night he was elected, there were major protests, and I think that that's been part of the reason that his supporters remain dug in. I mean, he is the most unpopular person ever elected president, and yet the people who voted for him are still reporting at, 85% levels that they would vote for him. And I think a big part of that is every time they see a protest, especially one that becomes unruly or filled with obscenities or becomes violent, they say, well, I wasn't sure about Donald Trump, but if these people are doing this, then I must have been right. For them, there might be a very small layer of undecided voters in there. And every time something like that happens, I would argue that they sit back and say, well, I was unsure until now, but I guess I must have been right.
Okay, Professor, keep searching for that great cell phone spot. I'm eager to get back to how you sounded a few minutes ago, but I want to ask what to do with this information, because you, as I said, you're not a Trump fan and you're not against protest. For example, you think that anti-Trump protesters could take a cue from the civil rights movement. What did those protesters get right?
I think that one of the things that that the civil rights protest got right was the inducing of shame in people who hadn't really thought that deeply about the subject beforehand, or had kind of grown up reflexively with it. I was a boy in the 1960s in New England in a working class family. My parents hadn't really thought a lot about civil rights, and I think that the dignity and the message that came through from those protests really did affect folks who hadn't thought deeply about this. I think that going into the streets every single day, turning the volume knob to 11, and pumping the outrage factor up over every single tweet is, first of all, I think that's a strategy on the part of the White House. And second, I think it makes people tone deaf to protest. It wears them out. It simply says, okay, another day, another group of people in the streets. I have no idea what they're yelling about. I mean, there really is a crying wolf issue here.
Then what do you say? How do you convince a Trump opponent who thinks, but President Trump isn't capable of shame, and maybe his supporters don't seem to respond to that same language of shame and what's right?
Well, one of the arguments that always comes back to me when I make this argument is to say, well, what we're really trying to do is pump up our own base to get our own people to come out and vote. And my answer is, if you need to have mass protests to get people to vote in when they wouldn't have voted in 2016, then something's wrong with the message here. I actually do think that there is a layer of people, a stratum of the electorate that was still mostly an anti-Hillary vote, that is uncomfortable with Trump's presidency, and they can be convinced. But having a protest in the middle of Times Square is not reaching out to people who disagree with you. That's a quick. If I were Trump, I would use that kind of footage as campaign footage 3 years from now.
Okay, I want to talk about your book as well, The Death of Expertise. Before we get there, one final word then of advice. If you're a Trump opponent, you should do what differently?
Well, I think the most important advice I can give to Democrats in particular is register and turn out. And, I've had this argument many times with people on social media about, I understand the problem of gerrymandering and suppression and all those other problems. But the fact of the matter is, people under 30, for example, never break the 50 to 51% ceiling of voter participation. If you're that angry about it, then do the hard work that is less fun and less emotionally charged than protesting. Get out there and register people to vote. Learn the rules of your local election commission. Pay attention to local offices. I worked in city, state, and federal government, and I can tell you that in city and state government, that's where most of the battles in politics are won and lost, even though people don't really think that, and that they think national-level protest is the way to go. Politics, Tip O'Neill was right. Politics are local.
And we have a local election this week. We're talking the day before the local election here, and your primary ballot is due by tomorrow. Talking with the National Security Affairs Professor Tim Nichols, you wrote this book called The Death of Tom Nichols. Sorry, Tom. You wrote this book called The Death of Expertise about how ignorance has become a virtue to Americans. How do you think this factors into the politics we're talking about right now?
Well, President Trump didn't create that, but he surfed it magnificently. We see it every day that during the campaign, he ran against experts. He's pushing experts out of the State Department and other parts of the U.S. government. This to me was the kind of revenge on the elites, because he took the word elite and the word expert and he hinged them together and convinced millions of people that their lives, that whatever's going wrong in their lives is the fault of some mysterious elite somewhere who knows more than they do and has more education than they do. And he turned that into a very powerful electoral force, taking populism and pushing it to the next level and wedding it to a kind of ignorance that we haven't really seen since the Know Nothing movement. And I think that's an extraordinarily dangerous thing in a republic, because a republic requires informed voters to make choices for people to make decisions on their behalf. And that's going haywire right now.
And do you see any sign that Democrats are either getting less elitist or seeming less elitist?
You know, it's such a strange place to be in, because I spent most of my life as a moderate Republican who worked with and alongside Democrats. So it's strange to be giving them advice. I hope that they are becoming more attuned to the problem of getting tagged with that. But, you know, there's a bigger problem that both Democrats and more responsible Republicans have, which is that if you're being tagged as the enemy simply because you know things, and because you have expertise in certain areas, you can't become stupid in order to win votes. But on the other hand, you can change your message so that it's more accessible to people who may be suspicious or untrusting of government, and, you know, who may be suspicious and untrusting for good reasons. But I hope that the Democrats get that message, because I think America needs a viable second party. I think the Republicans were once that viable second party, and now the Democrats are in the wilderness. I believe in a healthy two-party system, and I don't think we have one right now.
A moderate Republican who hopes Democrats can get their act together when it comes to appealing to the voting public. I've been talking with Tom Nichols, professor of national security affairs, U.S. Naval War College, and author of the book, The Death of Expertise. Tom, thanks a lot for this.
Thank you very much for having me.
KUOW's The Record. We're going to talk about an underside of Seattle's great tech success that you may not have considered. What happens when you bring together a lot of men and a lot of money? That's coming up in a moment. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter at KUOW. Seattle's success has an underside that you may not have considered. Our booming tech industry has brought in a lot of men and a lot of money. And wherever there are men with money, you will find prostitution. The Seattle Times has been writing about men starting a prostitution ring here, developing websites where Johns can review prostitutes and set up meetings at luxury apartments in Bellevue. Times reporter Lynn Thompson's been writing about how police finally brought the ring down. Lynn, welcome to KUOW.
Thanks, Bill.
You write that men who pay for sex come from a lot of backgrounds, but that in our area, prosecutors have found they are disproportionately tech workers from the East Side. Why?
I think because there are a lot of men in tech on the East Side, and they seem to be comfortable using their cell phones and booking dates and going to visit these women. I'm guessing that a lot of them are single. A lot of them work long hours. A lot of them think it's just more convenient to, you know, book a date with a prostitute than have a relationship.
East Side more so than Seattle?
I don't know if it's more so. It's sort of ironic. Bellevue has a reputation of being pretty squeaky clean, you know, more crime-free than Seattle. And they also have a pretty upscale downtown, and somehow that's attracted people. So what you got were some of these men renting or leasing the apartments, these upscale apartments in downtown Bellevue, for specifically Korean women who are coming here from South Korea or traveling a circuit around the country and staying in Bellevue for a couple weeks and then moving on to another city. So, you know, one detective said, you know, ironically, it's this reputation for being safe that has attracted some of the activity, but also, you know, it's convenient for tech workers to go see these women.
A group of men who use prostitutes regularly started up this website known as the Review Board. Where there were reviews of prostitutes? Will you describe that?
Yeah, this started way back in 2001. It was almost like the dawn of the internet. And a man named Sigurd Zitars, who was known by his screen name as Tahoe Ted, came up with this idea that he could put everything related to prostitution on one website. He would run free ads for women. He would screen the ads himself. And then for people who wanted to, you could join the conversation and write reviews of these women, comment on other people's review, rate the women, you know, do you recommend these women? And it became known as a Yelp for prostitution.
Of course, a lot of this has to do with just the availability of technology, tools we didn't used to have. Is that just a coincidence with the Seattle East Side tech boom?
To some extent, what detectives have said to me is every time there's an advance in technology, it's used for prostitution.
Really? What other examples of technology?
Well, I think just in the beginning, you know, as soon as there were cell phones, then it was a lot easier to book a date. Now you just you go online. There are ads. I think the detective said there were more than 100 websites in the Seattle area where you could online escort sites. Typically, they have ads for the women and a text number that you know so you can text and say, hey, are you available at 7 tonight or noon tomorrow? And so it just it's also anonymous. You're just using a phone number. You're not using your name. Typically, you did have to send in some kind of identification if it was your first date. And that was another bizarre thing that the men were, hundreds of them, were sending in, you know, photos of their work ID, you know, Amazon, Microsoft, Boeing, photos of their passport, their work website, you know, and the detectives were kind of dumbfounded, like, really? You know, this is a criminal enterprise that you're participating in.
I was reading your stuff thinking, how did they get away with it this long?
Well, I think they got really complacent because this review board had been around since 2001. Tahoe Ted did an interview in 2008 in Seattle Metropolitan Magazine, you know, essentially bragging about how great it was to be able to read in advance the women you want to meet and hear what other men said about what sex act she was willing to provide and how much it cost and how do you get into the condo without being detected by security. And, you know, this is all in a magazine and nothing happens to him. You know, he's not arrested. And so I think what happened was it evolved from isolated men booking dates to this organized activity. And suddenly these men were not just going to see a prostitute. They were leasing the apartments. They were connecting these prostitution agencies with photographers, placing the ads. Some of them were driving women back and forth from SeaTac. And it no longer resembled isolated men booking dates.
Is that what brought the ring down? Is all this activity, all these men coming to, you know, one apartment, shuffling in and out?
Absolutely. The tip that started the investigation was someone living, a resident of one of these Bellevue condos, who said, I think my neighbor's involved in sex work. There are men walking up and down the hall all times of day. They're all different body sizes, all different types. And, you know, essentially, you know, what are they doing here? And sent that to the police. So the police had, they'd been aware of the activity on the review board. And so they started looking into it more. And there started to be this explosion of brothels in Bellevue, which they could tell through the ads, you know, come see me tonight in Bellevue.
Yeah. Well, at least there's a downside. You know, it's not easy to run an increasingly large and busy prostitution ring in apartment complexes and stay under the radar. There was a group of men involved known as the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. Who were they?
They were a select group of men who met through the review board. So they had already shown their interest and involvement in seeking out prostitutes. And what they did was decide that what the Seattle area needed were South Korean prostitutes. And apparently there was a fairly large, thriving network or business of Korean prostitutes in Los Angeles. So there was this thought, well, we can tap into that. We have all this tech savvy among our members. We can create our own website, run ads, run reviews, promote these South Korean women. And so that coincided with the complaints coming in from residents of these Bellevue apartments that this activity, so this league just formed in early 2015, and that was right around the same time that the activity was picking up.
And what was life like for the women caught up in this prostitution ring?
You know, that's one of the things we know the least about. We know that some came directly from South Korea. Some spoke very little English. They had translator apps on their smartphones that they would use to communicate with the Johns. Sometimes they communicated with hand gestures. We know that they were isolated in these apartments, that they typically lived out of a suitcase. They were there for 4 or 5 weeks before they would move on to another city. The apartments were very sparely furnished. There were very few personal possessions in these apartments because it was more like a hotel room because no one lived there in a sense. And when you read the reviews that the police seized as a result of search warrants in this case, you get this picture that, you know, that some of the women, they're doing this for the first time. They're afraid. They have doubts about what they're doing. Some of the men complain that they don't seem completely into it, give them a bad review. And so there's really a pressure on them to perform, in a sense, to act like they love it. They're having a great time, make the men feel really special. Otherwise, they won't have customers. And clearly, they're doing it for the money. It was $300 an hour to see one of these women.
Were you able to get to know any of these women so that we can know whether they're doing any better today after the busting of this ring?
No. What happened was the police, and King County's been a national leader on this, they do not prosecute the women in prostitution. They treat them as victims. And so these women, on the day of the bust, it would have been, 12 women by chance who happened to be here, on their circuit. They were told that they were free to leave. There were translators available. They were given connections to social service agencies. Foreign prostitutes can apply for visas as victims of sexual violence. But it's not clear that any of the women did. And what the police have said is, as far as they know, they likely just moved on. You know, they went to the other, back to Los Angeles or just other cities in the country, continuing on this circuit, but no longer coming to Seattle.
Seattle Times reporter Lynn Thompson, we said at the very beginning that where there's men and money, there's prostitution. And you described how when there's a new technology, there's another way for there to be prostitution. So in a sense, this is the oldest story, right? The oldest profession. What surprised you when you looked into what's happening now in Bellevue?
I was surprised by the sheer number of men involved. I had no idea. The fact we talked about there being 100 different websites where you could book a date with a prostitute just in the Seattle area alone. There were about 23,000 members of the review board, which was open to all prostitutes, not just South Korean prostitutes. The K-Girl Delight site had 1 million page views in 1 month of 2015. So the sheer numbers of men involved was pretty staggering to me.
Well, then what about the numbers now? Police took down this group investigation spanning 8 months, shut down 12 brothels on the east side, 2 websites seized. And how much did that slow prostitution in this region?
What the detective said is there was a pause because the main way for men in the Puget Sound area to connect with prostitutes was the review board. Once that was seized by the King County Sheriff's detectives, that wasn't available. And so the activity flowed to other sites. There were still, you know, 99 other sites for finding escorts in the Seattle area. And it's really two of the men who were charged in the case. I talked to them, and one was pretty skeptical that the activity had diminished at all. He basically said there are new technologies where men can be even more anonymous than before, and there won't be a trail on their cell phones of who they've seen. And the detectives also said that other international enterprises moved in. So the Koreans were out, but then there were Thai, there were Chinese, there were Southeast Asian women. And I talked to the captain of the detectives unit in Bellevue last week. She was doing a community presentation and had one of her detectives kind of say, where are we at now with prostitution? And he went through the websites that he could find and estimated that there were 85 women, you know, back at work in Bellevue. So it's, you know, I sort of joke, this is a full employment opportunity for the detectives. You know, and they said there's so much money involved. There's a tremendous incentive for other organizations to rent the apartments, you know, press the women into service, advertise them, promote them, and, you know, try to make a lot of money.
It goes on. Lynn Thompson, reporter for the Seattle Times, thanks for your work.
Thanks very much for having me.
And we're tweeting out a link to her article, Busted, How Police Brought Down a Tech-Savvy Prostitution Ring in Bellevue. We'll see you again when you come back, Lynn. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
KUOW's The Record will be back in just a moment. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in today. Here heading up to Seafair Weekend. You know, if you watched Pirates Land on Alki Beach earlier this month, or you went to Ballard Seafood Fest, or Dragon Fest in the ID, or Renton River Days, you were at Seafair. If you're planning on going to Magnolia Summerfest this month, or Kirkland Summerfest, or watch the Blue Angels, or go to Salmon Fest, different from last month's Ballard Seafood Fest, whew, that's also Seafair. Since the 1950s, Seattle has had this sprawling multi-event festival that some Seattleites love, other Seattleites find confusing. The king and queen of Seafair are here to help guide you. Who better? King Neptune, also known as singer, writer, podcaster, John Roderick. Good to see you again, King.
Nice to be here. Thank you for having us.
Your Majesty and Your Highness Queen Alcyone, also known as Savor Seattle Food Tour founder, Angela Shen. Welcome, Your Highness.
Thank you for having me.
What does king and queen of Seafair mean? What power do you have over this, as I've just described, massive Seafair kingdom?
Well, we have comprehensive power. I mean,
free parking.
We can walk pretty much into anywhere in Seattle and get everything there handed to us on a silver platter.
Wow.
A silver platter embossed with the Seafair logo.
Uh-huh. It is
a ceremonial position, but one that is undefined. So it can be sort of described any way we like, really.
Really?
It's a thing where kind of like being a seafarer pirate, it's an opportunity more than anything.
We make up a lot of our own rules.
I see.
How we choose to reign.
Yeah, that's right.
So for those who either they're new to Seattle or they just never really got seafarer, John, you've been going to seafarer since you were a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Give us the seafarer love, and I'll ask the same of your queen.
Well, in the 1950s, it's hard to project that far back, but Seattle did not have any kind of real national presence. We were unknown in a lot of ways, a kind of blank space in the northwest corner of a map.
Yep.
When they would do national weather, they would say, you know, and it's raining in San Francisco, and then moving on to, like, there wasn't even a Seattle in most people's minds.
Yeah.
And so Seattle had to make its own culture. We didn't have national sports teams. We weren't we weren't connected. And also in America at the time, there were regional cultures. It wasn't this monolithic culture. So Seafair was the one time of the year when the whole city kind of gathered in celebration of our nautical heritage and just as a kind of time for us to be rowdy. Looking back at the seafarers of old, the city went off. I mean, people were dressed in their finery.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out the one national sporting event that we did excel at was high-speed boat racing.
Yeah.
And we had
we dominated.
We
for a
did.
While
we had champion pilots from here, so it was something we could really be proud of.
Okay, that's the long view of Seafair. Queen Alcyone, Angela, you've only lived here about a decade or so. What does Seafair mean to you?
Gosh, so Seafair for me was brand new this year. When they called me and they said, we'd like to offer you the position of Seafair Queen for 2017, I actually thought it was a joke. I didn't even know, truth be told, that there was such a thing as Seafair royalty.
Uh-huh.
And so I had to learn about Seafair very, very, very quickly. And I think that honestly was probably the best thing that could have ever happened to me. My line of work, I own a tourism business here in Seattle. Of course, you know, a transplant, having never set foot in Seattle, decides to start a tourism company in a city she's not even from. Why not? Gets crowned Seafair Queen. Seems very appropriate. So each of these events that we've been to has been really eye-opening for me to connect with the community and actually experience this history that John talks so fondly about. Just this past Saturday, we were both in the Torchlight Parade representing King Neptune and Queen Alcyone. I had the pleasure of having my kids and my husband in the car with us. And it was just phenomenal seeing 250,000 people coming to the streets of Seattle to witness this parade, and every cross-section of Seattle and every kid was out in the streets, big smiles, and my two littles, they were dressed as Spider-Man and Queen Elsa. So it really didn't matter that I was Queen Alcyone. Everybody thought it was the Spider-Man and, and Queen Elsa float coming down.
Let's get at that. John, how is it that there are 250,000 smiles as just described, you know, all the joy that's going on, and yet, well, here's Lisa on Facebook who says, each year I vow that I'm going to pay attention to the dates and go to all the neighborhood celebrations. Each year I fail. There is this, it's a little strange how Seafair is such a success and such a cipher or such an annoyance to some people.
It's overwhelming. And, you know, for a lot of people, I think the loud jets and the loud boats are off-putting because they're intrusive.
Have you been to our Facebook page?
I haven't, but I have lived in Seattle a long time.
Yeah.
And this has all been part of the transition from Seattle being a small regional city that had a kind of unified sense of itself to being this metropolis that has people from all over, a lot of people that haven't lived here a long time. And the jets and the boats seem a little NASCAR to the urban sophisticates that live within the city center, who are like, wow, this is loud and also a waste of our taxpayer dollars. And
is that elitist?
I think that it is. It's indicative of kind of a cultural problem, not problem, but a cultural.
You said problem. Go
let's
ahead.
Let's say problem, just in the sense that, you know, the Navy is here, and within the ivory tower communities of our central city, there isn't that same close relationship with the Navy that maybe there once was, or that there is in other parts of the country, and there does become a cultural divide where loud exploding things and people marching in uniform isn't the way that Fremont anymore celebrates its summer.
Yeah.
If it were up to Fremont, who declared themselves a nuclear free zone 40 years ago or whatever.
So those critics, you are King Neptune. You have the power to behead them if you wanted to, right?
I'm very sympathetic to them.
Okay.
But I also feel like part of why Angela and I accepted this job and are excited about it is to remind people that this is a very Seattle event.
Mm-hmm.
And for people that are transplanted here or people that maybe have over the years divorced themselves from Seafair, there are these neighborhood festivals. There's a lot of opportunity and a lot of things that are free.
The milk carton derby. There's a lot.
Sure. A ton of stuff going on that's all very kid friendly. And there are ways to interact with Seafair on your own terms?
I think it's a way for you as a local to fall back in love with Seattle. I think we take a lot of things for granted that we have all of these great neighborhoods in our back pocket. I mean, I can tell you as a transplant here 10 years ago, I was floored. I couldn't believe the great fresh seafood that comes from our waters, the incredible produce, and this place that is really beloved, Pike Place Market even, right, is something that even locals, when you say those words, they kind of cringe at. But these are really iconic Seattle places and things. And I can tell you that being involved with Seafair this year has really, even for me, re-inspired this love. And being able to pass this on to my kids and subsequent generations, I don't want this tradition to ever die.
Okay. So could you ever see Seafair surviving but without the Blue Angels? That is the number one gripe on our Facebook page.
Sure. I mean, we have a nautical history here, and the Navy plays a big part in Washington. And we forget that, you know, the military is a major, I mean, it is something that it, within Seattle, we're not a culture that, I mean, we are imagining a future world where there doesn't need to be a military. That's Seattle's range, uh-huh. Right? But at least for now there is, and it represents
a lot.
Think
of that noise as their last gasp.
But also, like, we're all decrying the 50,000 people that Amazon is bringing in from all around the world. But we're not making that effort to introduce them to our culture. We can't just complain about them arriving. We need to promulgate our lasting culture and reintroduce it to people.
All right. King Neptune and Queen Alcyone, our time is up. What happens when Seafair ends? Sometimes it doesn't end well for royalty. Hopefully it's going to go okay for you.
This is a year-long appointment.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, year-long appointment.
You do this in January, too.
And the beard. I do like the full mustache and beard, King
right,
Neptune.
I've been growing it out, and now it's full of barnacles.
John Roderick is King Neptune and a Seattle musician and writer. Angela Shen is Queen Alcyone and the founder and CEO of Savor Seattle Food Tours. Seafair festivities started back in June, extend through August, and you've got Seafair weekend this weekend, Blue Angels, hydroplane races, all happening this weekend. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Angels, daredevils of the sky.